Good Monday afternoon and welcome into Grant and Danny. You are listening live to The Fan. It's August 4th, 2025, a Commanders game week as they've got a preseason game on Friday. Danny is out today. He is out for the week. He is actually in Scotland. I've got Toby Altizer hanging out with me in studio on Half Street in the Navy Yard. Hello, Toby.
What's going on, dude? I saw that Danny was hanging out in a place that I would love to be, St. Andrews.
Oh, was he really?
Yeah. He was saying that he needs to get a little more into golf before he goes there, so I think that's my new objective, is to get Danny into golf.
I did not. Well, good luck with that. I don't know how much that's going to happen. Unless he can go play in the mornings or something. He'll play any sport, any activity he can, generally in the mornings before the show. But, yeah, I don't know if golf's going to be next in line for him. But we got a nice show planned for you today. Dorrance Armstrong, defensive end, finished very strong and had a great pro season for the Commanders. Likely to be their number one edge rusher in terms of snaps this year. Von Miller might be their top pass rusher efficiency-wise. But Dorrance Armstrong is a guy that's going to be on the field for running downs as well. He joins us coming up at 2:45. And then Kane Medrano, the linebacker out of UCLA, drafted in the sixth round, who's had a pretty fun training camp. He's made a couple of plays in every single practice when he's gotten some opportunities. I think he's mostly going to be a special teamer right away, but he's trying to earn his way defensively as well. He'll stop by for a quick conversation at 6 o'clock before Nats baseball tonight. We're going to start with football in a second. I just want to say on the Nats, they got swept, Toby, this weekend, 38-14. They got outscored by the Milwaukee Brewers in three games. 38 runs allowed. They have a 16 spot put up against them, a 14 spot put up against them, and then somehow only 8 runs in the third game. We're at a point with this Nats team where this is as bad a series performance and maybe even roster as I remember them fielding over the era that started with 2012 in the playoffs. So over the last 13 or so years, it's pretty much rock bottom in terms of the on-field product. But my goodness, I don't know where the wins are going to come from or how they're going to get out. Their pitching staff right now is an absolute disaster.
Yeah, I mean, luckily the Athletics come into town starting tomorrow, so maybe they can get a couple of wins in that series, but the Brewers are one of the best teams in baseball, and that offense is just relentless. They just keep coming at you and coming at you. It's not all homers. It's not all big flies, but it's just single, double, good base running play, all those sorts of things, and you compound that with a team that can't get outs, and that's how you end up with 56 hits in three games.
So at Commanders training camp late last week, I saw Bryce Terang, who's the starting second baseman for the Milwaukee Brewers, Gold Glove caliber player, and he's the brother-in-law of Tress Way. So Tress's wife is his older sister. And he came into town a day early. The Brewers had allowed him to come in because Tress and Bree, his wife, were adopting formally, like getting the last name now for their baby that they adopted that we talked about on the show back in the playoffs. But anyway, Terang was the uncle of this baby. Was in town and came in early, and he was at practice hanging out with Tress, and he came over and Tress introduced me, and I was asking him just about Nats Park and what it's like to play at, and he was like, "So how have the Nats been here lately?" And I'm like, "Oh, it's gotten ugly." I literally said to him, I'm like, "Don't worry, you guys will have a fine series. You'll get out of here with, if you don't have two wins, somebody did something very wrong." Now they got all three, and Terang had a two homer game and had a monster series,
first of his career, by the way.
I believe
first two homer game.
I mean, everybody on the Brewers got fat. It was just kind of funny. He's like, "How are things going with the Nats?" And I'm like, "They're going well enough that you guys will not only sweep them, but it's going to be one of those games where you wish it was like pickup where you could just grab the bat and walk up to the plate."
Yeah.
Because they're not going to get anybody out. But it was ugly. So enough on the Nats. We may never talk about them again. I'm only kidding. But my God, are they terrible.
Tough.
In this moment. But they're off today. We can get back into them closer to the end of the show when we look ahead to tomorrow. But I do want to start with training camp and with practice today. You and I were both out there at the facility in Ashburn. And there were three guys specifically that stood out to me, I thought, worth mentioning today. And I want to go through them one by one here. The first is Jalen Lane, the wide receiver from Virginia Tech. It is very clear to me when I watch practice right now that almost every single time Jalen Lane gets on the field, he is almost immediately targeted.
Mm-hmm.
And at the beginning of training camp, he was working with the threes, occasionally with the twos. And you would notice him some, but he was kind of down the depth chart. He's getting a lot of run right now when Jaden Daniels is at quarterback, throwing him the football against top corners. And he continues to show out. This is a guy who runs a 4.3 4.40. He's small. I was talking to one of the Commanders beat writers on the sideline. And they said, you know who he reminds me of? And maybe it's just the number and his size. But he dropped a Tyler Lockett on him, which I found kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Lockett's an undersized guy, wears number 83 as well.
And was a returner at K-State.
Right, good comp. Yeah, exactly. And in Lane's case, he has gotten deep and open a lot, especially on what I call like plaster plays where we're off schedule now. And Jaden Daniels, with that extra beat, or even Sam Hartman earlier in camp, has now gotten out of the pocket and flushed, and everybody kind of scatters, and Lane kind of just becomes the deepest guy. Mm-hmm. And all camp long, I feel like he's made one play after another. But if you comp him, say, to Luke McCaffrey, who's another young receiver, it seems like whenever Luke's out there, there's not as many targets, but a lot of things on snaps happen where you go, ah, he was this close, where he gets tangled up with a corner, or he falls down, or he can't make the catch, or he's got a guy draped over him. But when they throw to Lane, it just works. He's open. He makes catches. It's been constant. There was one play, Toby, today where he was going against Jonathan Jones. Not going to start for the Commanders probably right away, but longtime veteran corner in New England.
Good
played
player.
A lot last year.
Yeah.
They're one-on-one in the slot. Jones is playing in the nickel. And Lane had this twitchy top of his route stem where he kind of like plants and goes in and breaks out. And Jones was left 3 to 4 yards behind him, and he makes a catch and gets to the sideline in a 30-second drill at the end of a half. And I'm telling you, like, over and over again, if I'm taking notes, I go, 83, 83, 83. This was Cliff Kingsbury today talking about the rookie wide receiver who runs a sub-440 from Virginia Tech.
He's been very impressive. He's a coach's kid, been around the game his entire life, and if you tell him how to do it one time, he usually nails it. And then if he makes a mistake, he'll come back and get it corrected. But super, super talented, very fast. I've been really impressed. I don't think I could see some of those things at Virginia Tech, watching the film and getting him here in person and watching him run around and watching the coachability and the route tree that he can run. It's been really impressive.
I was standing next to Adam Kilgore, who was covering the team at camp for the Washington Post, who was going to be on the Blitz today. And it was funny because we were both kind of marveling over some of the plays that he was making. And Kilgore said, and it was a great line, he goes, tired, Ja'Cory Krosky Merritt, young standout. Wired, Jalen Lane. Everyone's talked about Merritt. He's had a great camp. I don't think enough people are talking about Jalen Lane.
Yeah, the thing is, what's interesting about Jalen Lane is what you heard Cliff say is he didn't really run routes down the field at Virginia Tech. It was one of the things I was interested to see in camp. One of the things I'm interested to see going forward is how is he used in this offense? Because I already know from watching him with the Hokies last year, he can do the Debo stuff, all of it. And he's a little bit different. He's not as thick as Debo. Debo's going to run through tackles versus he's going to be elusive and dodge people. But they can
but
do similar.
They wanted to get him the ball in space.
Correct.
So they'd occasionally just throw him the ball into the backfield with nobody around him.
Once a game, and I have no idea how whoever Virginia Tech was playing that week, never game planned for it. Once a game, they'd run an end around and he'd pop it for 30 yards. Every single week. He was so good at that. But he never ran down the field. The final game of the year against UVA, they finally hit him on a deep ball, and he scored a touchdown, like 70-yarder. But they didn't do a whole lot of that. So I think that's what Cliff's talking about, is Jalen Lane today, I was watching a couple of times just to see how he would match up against Amos, which we're going to get to in just a second, because he was impressive today. But running go routes, running posts, running stuff down the field, they didn't do that a whole lot of Tech. So I think that's part of the reason he fell to the fourth round is, okay, he's a gadget guy, right? He's kind of a guy that has to line up in the slot, and he can do a little bit of this and that. Like you talked about, underneath stuff, he is shifty. He can create separation underneath. He's electric with the ball in his hands. The thing that he didn't do a lot of Tech was go down the field, and I think that he can do that. And I think part of the reason he fell to the fourth round is Virginia Tech just wasn't very good last year, frankly. The quarterback play wasn't
certainly
great.
Certainly not offensively,
The offensive line that maybe didn't give the time to go down the field, right? I think that you could see this guy be their most versatile receiver in terms of he's catching the ball behind the line of scrimmage. He might line up in the backfield and play that Debo type role. They're moving him. He's going down the field. He can do everything, and he's electric when he gets the ball.
I always try to stop myself with wide receivers who are having big practices because, as you saw with Luke McCaffrey and so many other guys, it's a really hard position when you're a mid or late round pick. You know, in Luke's case, it's third round. In Lane's case, it's fourth round. But when you're not drafted right at the top of the board, you don't necessarily get the looks. They're not crowbarring you into the game plan and giving you targets. it is just notable to me that when he gets those first team reps, almost always he gets a quick target. You know, when he's out there, it's Debo-like in the sense that, you know, Debo Samuel, if you look at the snaps he's getting in practice in terms of snap count, I'll bet you it's not that high, but they get him in there to get his work and they get him back out. Like, he's out there, he's catching a pass, they're doing something around the line of scrimmage, they're running a dig in the middle of the field, back to the sideline. It almost feels like Jalen Lane, who's in a similar role, is getting some of that same work. But what I find so fun about him is, in a world where there's no Terry McLaurin right now, you look at the receiver position. Noah Brown has not been healthy, has not been practicing 11s. So you're down your top two, potentially, traditional receivers, if Debo's this tweener who plays all over the place. So the receiver room is Michael Gallup, or the ghost of him, years since his last big season. Mm-hmm. Luke McCaffrey, who, as I mentioned, you know, I think Lane is having a more impressive camp then. And then it's Chris Moore, who had a couple of big catches today. I think he, of the veterans, like, I would actually like him and find him more interesting right now than Michael Gallup, oddly enough. K.J. Osborne is kind of down there with Gallup. Haven't really noticed him very much. But if we're just talking about practice, Allen Iverson style, we talk about practice. The best receivers at camp, take Debo out of the equation because he's just a gadget, you know, weapon, so to speak. It's been Jalen Lane, and, you know, then you got to have a conversation about who number two is. What that means when they start actually playing live football against the Patriots this weekend, we're going to find out. But I do want to just point out that he had a great practice. And with Cliff talking about him today, I thought it was bringing up.
Yeah, and I think, too, Cliff had mentioned a little bit earlier in his presser saying, with Terry out, with Noah Brown not able to practice, that you kind of get these opportunities that maybe you wouldn't usually, because you're having more reps of Jalen Lane with the ones. You're having more reps of Luke McCaffrey with the ones. And he said it's an opportunity to figure out if either of these guys go down. Obviously, when Terry's back, when Noah Brown, they step right back in. But you get an opportunity to see, okay, who's the next guy up? You mentioned Luke McCaffrey. There have been some plays he hasn't been able to make. Jalen Lane has made the plays.
So
that stands
out. Here's the difference between those two to me that I've seen. Luke McCaffrey does a really good job operating underneath against zone. It seems to me like he separates and kind of just throttles it down. Remember, he was a quarterback. I think he's really smart in that way. Second-generation player. His father, Ed, was a great wide receiver. Mm-hmm. His brother is an MVP-caliber player. Against zone, he seems to operate kind of between the numbers, hash marks, and do a lot of good things underneath. When they play against man, he does not get free. He does not really separate. He seems to always have guys draped over him, and that is just not the case with Lane. He just has so much more wiggle. Speaking of which, man coverage heavy today, I thought, in some of the 11 stuff that they were doing, 11 on 11. Trey Amos had a heck of a practice.
Incredible day.
I really, really like Trey Amos. Now, it's early, and I'm going to use my same caveat of, let's watch some real football at some point before we get too excited. But all we can do right now is watch the practices and see who stands out. Amos had a play where he's just step for step in stride with Debo. He had a great play down the field on McCaffrey with a PBU. He just seems to always be blanketed over a receiver in man coverage. And he's confident. He's got length. We had him on the show last week. I think people heard the kind of mentality that he provides as a personable guy who feels good about where he's at and is confident that he can play in this league. But the biggest reason to me for this storyline of the corners are having a great camp, Lattimore certainly looks like he's healthier and running better than he did at the end of last season. It's nice to bring in a guy like Jonathan Jones. It's Trey Amos, man. Like, right now, he's basically the outside corner as the number two opposite Lattimore. And in most practices, he looks great. My big question is this because of the receivers he's going up against? Like, if you're running with Luke McCaffrey or Michael Gallup or, you know, K.J. Osborne, that's different than when week one you're going to be following Malik Nabers around. I get that. But I kind of view it almost like baseball, where I'm not telling you this guy's going to hit 300 forever, but you see him in one game and he puts four balls in play and he has a high exit velocity. Like, there is a starter kit here with Amos that I really like.
He's always around the football. He's always near the guy that he's supposed to be covering. And, you know, there was one ball that he ended up giving up to Debo Samuel, but Debo ran a perfect route, stemmed, ran a dig route about 15 yards down the field. But he's step for step, he's right there. It's not like it was, whoa, we got turned around or anything. He's right there, and those things are going to happen. That's called playing in the NFL against really good players. But the thing that was so impressive was he made multiple plays, and the last play of practice that you've already mentioned, where McCaffrey's running a go route, he's step for step with him, and the technique was perfect, Grant, where it was watching, and then finally gets his head around, and then once he tracks the ball, puts his left hand out and just swats it away. Like, that's the sort of stuff that we saw other corners here in the past be able to do. They were able to stick step for step, but then they'd panic, and they'd grab the guy, or they'd push the guy, or they wouldn't get their head around. The next thing you know, the ball's right by him. Nope. Perfect technique by Amos. Gets the head around, swats it away, and that's the stuff that I think we've seen with other guys that maybe just isn't as teachable as you think. Like, either have that or you don't. It's pretty clear for him. He's got the ball skills necessary, and he's always sticky with whoever he's covering.
Yeah, the pick today was a ball skills pick. It was that out route slightly behind Chris Moore, so like on his back shoulder. Mm-hmm. It was from Daniels on like a 10, 12-yard out, and Moore has Amos beat by a step toward the sideline. Daniels puts it on his back shoulder, so he kind of slows up to reach back. But he's got the ball pinned, and then Amos kind of rips it away from him because he's so close in coverage. And it's the kind of play you do see in the league occasionally. But I think the ball skills are there. It just looks different. You know, even when I remember the beat, a lot of the folks on the cover the team every day were like super impressed by Emmanuel Forbes in his rookie training camp. And then you watched him in that first preseason game, and it's like, this is the guy, really? I bet you that's not what it's going to look like with Amos. But we're going to get our first crack of game action against New England to watch this team on Friday night. The Commanders are traveling tomorrow. They've got a practice on Wednesday. Then they'll be off for a walkthrough Thursday. And then Friday night, preseason game number one in Foxborough, which will be a lot of fun. Grant and Danny. Danny's out today. Toby Altizer's in. One more guy. These are three takeaways, three players that stood out to me at practice. And in all three cases, this is kind of the last week or so, I like these guys kind of continually. Matt Gay, the kicker. So he did miss one kick today from 55, wide to the left. Plenty of leg, and he just missed. Prior to that, he drilled 50 and 55 yarders, and the 55 yarder would have been good from beyond 60.
Mm-hmm.
He crushed it. Adam Peters actually went up and gave him a big hug after he nailed the 55-yarder. And I don't know what the interaction was about, but I have to imagine it has something to do with the fact that last year they went through seven kickers and had a guy that barely made a chip shot to beat Tampa Bay. And I think he's pretty happy that they have a grown-up real kicker here in Matt Gay. But I think that's one of the storylines that's gone under the radar. And I get it. Like, there's so many things to focus on and talk about. You got Laremy Tunsil at left tackle. Debo's new in the receiver room. Bobby Wagner back. And Zach Ertz re-signing a contract. Daniel's in year two. You got a draft class. Guys like Connor Lee you're trying to keep an eye on. But going from having more kickers than anybody in the league last season to someone who might actually be a strength at that position would be a massive upgrade. And I believe Gay's missed two kicks all training camp long at this point. The length is not the strength. 50 and beyond has been, over the last couple of seasons, a little bit questionable. But inside of 50 has been automatic. And they don't go for a ton of field goal attempts in that 50 to 55 range, because they go for so many fourth downs because they have Jaden Daniels. So I actually think this marriage could be perfect. But right now, this moment, for the first time in a few years, when they line up for a field goal, I feel like it's going to go in.
Yeah, he's not going to be a weapon. You know, like, you think about McPherson when the Bengals went on their run, Justin Tucker for years with the Ravens. Guys like that, you feel like is a weapon because you cross midfield and you can knock one through. That's not necessarily going to be the case, but he is a security blanket. And the fact that anytime you get inside 50 yards, he's going to probably knock it through. And you feel pretty good about that. And that's something that you haven't been able to say here for quite some time. So having a guy that when it's fourth and five at the 30, you know, before it was like, well, we'll feel okay, but now you're like, okay, we can trot the kicker out. We don't feel like we have to push it with Jaden Daniels here. To your point, this team doesn't love to kick field goals over 50 because, you know, if it's fourth and two, I can just go ahead and figure out a way to get Jaden Daniels to get 3 yards, right?
Yeah, do you think they'll kick more field goals 50-plus because Gay's better than what they had, or do you think fourth and four or less, that's still go-for-it range?
It's probably still go-for-it range most of the time,
too.
But there's at least a confidence that if you go, well, we're going to play this one conservatively, that you're actually going to knock it through. Because before, I think it was like, do we go for it and just give the ball, or do we, like, 30% chance we make this field goal?
Exactly. Right? I think that's the difference is you're doing a math equation in your head, and maybe even the analytics guys upstairs are helping Dan Quinn in his headset. And in the past, there might be a 35% chance you hit that field goal. Well, if the chances are now 50%, there are going to be more times mm-hmm. where you probably elect to send out the field goal kicker, but you got a cheat code. It's not a coincidence that the Ravens have gone for more fourth downs in that range than anybody else in the league in plus territory the last several years. Lamar is impossible to defend in short yardage with the ability to hand the football or keep it, and you've got a guy just like that now on fourth down who's your cheat code in Jaden Daniels. But those are the three guys I wanted to star from today's practice, including a little love for the kicker, Matt Gay. One thing that isn't getting a lot of attention now that camp has started is the age of this football team. The Commanders are not only the oldest team in the league, they're kind of considerably older than everybody else. Is that something that should be a concern? How will that rear its head, if at all, this season? I want to get into that next. You'll hear from Dorrance Armstrong, who finished very well on the edge as a sack artist for the Commanders last year at 245. This is The Fan. That's a live update, baby. A live update on 106.7 The Fan. Welcome back, Grant and Danny. Toby Altizer is in for Danny Hutier. Happy to be with you until 6:30 tonight. Keeping you company on your flagship home for the Nats and the Caps. Want to get into the Commanders' age, something not being talked a lot about, but that could rear its head as an issue this season in just a few. But your boy is a circus guy. Big circus guy. I took the kids to the Universe Soul Circus.
Okay.
National Harbor under the tent this weekend. Are you familiar with the Universe Soul Circus?
Not really, no.
You need to be. It's the best. So I'm sure you've done like Ringling Brothers, Barnum and Bailey. Have you done one of those when you were growing up? Go to the circus, see the elephants, do all that. Were you a circus guy?
I went once or twice.
Oh, man. This was like
not big time.
Wheelhouse childhood for me. The smell. Like, if you just blindfold me and somehow get a cup of circus smell, and then you open the cup right in front of my nose, I'd be like, oh, my God, I'm back at the circus. It's the best. So I take my kids. This is the second straight year we've done it. You walk in. You're under the tent. How they fit everything. I mean, they've been doing it for like 30 years, so it's not that big of a tent, but everything's under there just so. My kids get their faces painted. Then they need to buy the little like lights that light up.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Everything goes dark. Now we got to get toys. Now we got to pay for $10 pictures with the clowns. I mean, finally we sit down. I'm like, oh, I thought it was at 3. It's at 3:30. So we got 40 minutes to wait. By the end of this thing, you're seeing incredible acts. I got dirt bike dudes going off, like under a tent, going off of huge ramps, loud, smelling like fuel under the tent. It was the best. Circus guy. But I realize as much as I love taking my kids, and they are all about it, they go home and they start jumping on pillows and they're trying to get their circus acts down, it's really about me too, because I am 10 years old every single time I do it. So I ask you guys, before we get into the Commanders and their age, what is something that when you do it, you're just a kid again? Immediately back to being like 10 to 12 years old, and you are just at your childhood youthful exuberance best. Circus for me is that thing. I took them last year. I took them this year. And both times, I'm like buying them anything I can because it's just me as a kid being a dad, basically. It's the best. You guys got anything that when you think about, I do that, I might as well be 10 again?
I mean, it's not really an activity, but it's more so when Scott Hansen has the countdown on NFL Red Zone. Like, back in 2009 when it first launched, it was like this thing. I was like, oh, yeah, we're going to try Red Zone out. And he's like, and it's 7 hours of commercial-free footballs that starts now. I mean, it just takes me back to when I was 10 years old, year one of this thing, and I love it.
All right, but that is something that is, like, you could be 60 and enjoy Red Zone.
No.
That's not geared toward...
I can be 26 and not enjoy Red Zone.
But it's
you could be wrong, too.
It's nostalgia for me at this point. Okay. Like, I just look back at that time, and it's like, just like, I was had goldfish and a Coca-Cola. And watch
it's great.
Football on a Sunday.
I understand, but you can do that today. I will accept your answer. It does not play for me in this category because it's not designed for being young. It's not something you do as a kid and then you don't do again until you have kids, basically. Strober, you got anything?
Yeah, for me, I think it's jumping off the diving board at the pool.
That's pretty damn good.
Because when I was younger, I was obsessed with the idea with being able to do really cool stuff on the diving board. Flips, one and a halfs, try to do doubles off the high dive. I'd go to this indoor pool near my house in Germantown, and I'd go for that. Oh, it was a lot of fun. I hurt myself a couple times trying to take it a little bit too far and do stuff that I wasn't capable of doing. And then as I got older, I stopped doing it. Now I think I'm too afraid to do it because I don't want to get hurt. But every time I do actually go on a diving board and do like a real dive or a flip, this makes me feel like a kid again.
You're a child. That's great. I have not been on a diving board probably in 20 years.
We had a pool growing up, an in-ground pool, yeah. And we had a diving board that broke when I was probably 7 or 8. That thing never got fixed.
Do you know how many pools have broken diving boards? That's like part of having a pool, I think.
Yeah.
Like if there was a guy that just went around fixing diving boards, he'd make all the money. But I'm trying to think, it would have been when I was like sub high school, the last time I jumped off of a diving board, for sure. That's a great answer.
Right. Oh, I was going to give my answer.
Yeah, go for it.
Two things real quick. Going to a football game still gets me. Football games still get me because I don't go cover the games, so I'll just go as a fan. Those still get me. And if I'm going golfing with family, I'm researching the golf course the night before. I'm playing the round in my head. That's how I still am.
Is that something you guys did when you were young, go golfing?
Yeah. Yeah.
I get that one. That makes sense. I mean, family outings like that can definitely take you back.
Like my dad and I went this past week, and it was just a par 3 course that I played 5 or 6 times, and I was still going through like, all right, each hole, I'm going to hit 8-iron here, 7-iron here. Yeah, it doesn't matter. If I'm going golfing with family, always makes me feel like a kid again.
All right, let's complete the show circle here. So we got Clary, Strober, Toby down. Dad, what do you got?
So there's not many of these true ones anymore these days. So the closest thing you get to it is going to say like a Dave and Buster's or a Chuck E. Cheese or something like that. But going to the arcade, there was
grown-up arcades, by the way.
Yeah.
That's now a thing. Like a couple bachelor parties I've done.
For sure.
We've done that where you just, it's drinking, it's shots, it's a bunch, and Papa Shot at the same time. Like it's the grown-up arcade thing is a blast.
Yeah, for sure. But yeah, I mean, growing up, it was, if it wasn't spending summer days at the pool, it was spending summer days in the arcade at the mall. And yeah, anytime you get a chance to do that and kind of relive that these days is definitely something that's a blessing.
Family Feud style, we all got to clap and go, good answer!
Good answer!
All right, the Commanders are old. Speaking of age, let's talk about an old football team. So I saw a graphic that stood out to me from, this looks like Tyler Webb data via bookies. But the way that this graphic was done is what made it jarring. So, you know how you can, like, finagle with visuals, ways of making things look better or worse just based on the metrics you're using? So what I mean by that is the average age of the Washington Commanders is 27 and a half years old, and the next oldest team is the Steelers at 26.8. So when you look at it and you just say, okay, well, you round the Steelers up to 27, the Commanders are 27 and a half, what's really the difference? But when it's laid out the way this was, where every single decimal point is an option, pretty much the entire league is between 25.6 and 26.8. 29 teams. The Packers are the youngest team in the league at 25.1 as an average age. And then the Jets and the Eagles are standalone, the second youngest teams in the league at 25.4. But nobody above the Steelers is 26.9, 27.0, 27.1, 27.2, 27.3, 27.4. You got to get to the Commanders at 27.5. So I'm going to show you the visual of what I'm talking about here, Toby, of just all the teams linked together in age, and then the Commanders standalone way up top.
Yeah.
By the way, the team they're chasing in the division, the team in the NFC East that's got a stranglehold on the district here, and coming off of a Super Bowl, the Eagles are one of the three youngest teams in the NFL. Depending on the cuts that the Jets make and the Eagles make, it could be only Green Bay that's younger than Philly, and yet Washington is not only the oldest, but they are decidedly the oldest team. Now, some of this is, you know, you re-up with Bobby Wagner, and maybe he's around for one more year, same with Ertz, but you're counting big on those guys. I was talking to someone in football about this last week, and they go, yeah, but Wagner, you wanted to re-sign him, I'm sure. Sure. You wanted to re-sign Ertz. Like, those are good football players. But as guys get older, the risk of injury climbs. The risk of running into a wall and just not quite performing the same climbs. Someone would say, oh, well, the punter Tressway affects this. Okay, fine. So that's a player. But let's not pretend like they didn't, all offseason, basically go about their entire hiatus with zero regard for getting younger, because that's exactly what happened. Like, when you look at what they did, they signed, traded for, or re-signed 20 players that are either 30 or older or will be 30 by the end of this football season. Now, the league's getting a little bit older, I think, to some extent with competitive, you know, contending teams like Washington. But 20 players that are 30 or more, funny enough, now they're putting the flag in, drawing the line at Terry McLaurin because he's too old to pay him.
Ironic.
But I guess my point is, this is something that is not really getting talked about, and I think it should at least be acknowledged from the standpoint of they were pretty healthy last year. The guys that they brought in that were older, like Wagner, like Ertz, had great seasons. But the reason it's interesting when you go that route and you get older is that more often than not, it doesn't work that way. And it's just kind of one of those, let's not forget about this.
Sure.
Might not rear its head, but it's certainly something I think that's not getting talked about that is worth acknowledging.
So when you go through this roster and you look at just the starters, looking at a simple depth chart, the guys that would be under that, you said 27 and a half. The guys that would be under that average, Jaden, Brian Robinson, Biotish, I think, is 27, so maybe somewhere in there, Cosme, Josh Connerly, if he starts. And then on the defensive side, I think Luvu's over it. So you're looking at, like, Sanra Still, Quan Martin, Igbinoghene's still only 25, by the way, which is crazy to think about, former first-round pick. But there's not a lot. The issue is, I don't know that there's another way to go about this, because the reason being is you didn't have young guys when you brought over Ron's old roster. The roster sucked. So what else are you trying to do? And I think part of it is they were probably thinking when they got over here that it was going to take a little bit of time. And then your quarterback is so dang good that you're like, well, we got to create a really good roster right away. And so in turn, you end up with older guys. But, you know, to people's credit, 35-year-old Bobby Wagner brings it up a lot. 35-year-old Bobby Wagner was an All-Pro last year. He can still play.
Yeah, he was a second-team All-Pro, but I guess my point is, like, we did notice that the foot speed fell off some, and sure, you wonder, but, like, another year later, it's very possible that there's a significant regression.
And that's where you need Jordan McGee to step in. That's why this draft class is the last two are so important. They have to be able to step in as these guys start to fall off a little bit. Zach Ertz, I hope he can recreate what he did last year. What if he doesn't? Is Ben Sinnott ready to step in? That's where these guys that you've drafted over the last couple of years have to step in. They were left with an empty cupboard. So it's always going to be an older roster until you can truly reset probably over half of it with your own draft picks.
Yeah, but you have to want to reset, and you have to make it a priority, and you have to attack it.
What would you do differently?
Well,
this offseason.
So two things. One, I don't have a problem with what they've done.
Okay.
But it is a reality that they have
100%.
To deal with. And it's something that I think could blow up in their face.
Sure.
They're playing with fire. It didn't last year. It doesn't always blow up. In fact, it's like the game where you add a little bit more water and a little bit more water, and eventually, like, it, you know, the whole thing comes crashing down. It may not, but what would I do differently? Well, if the goal is to win a playoff game this year or multiple playoff games, I wouldn't do anything differently. But they are eventually pushing off the possibility of getting younger when you trade the number of draft picks they have.
For sure.
And I have no issue doing it. I wanted to trade for Laremy Tunsil. I wanted to trade for Deebo Samuel. I would have gone further, by the way, and traded for Trey Hendrickson, for the record. My point is just, you need Jaden Daniels to be exceptional to make this work. Check last year, and hopefully check again. And to your point, they will have to find a way to replace these guys if they get injured. But that's kind of my fear, and we'll talk about this later in the show. If this thing goes sideways this year, how did it happen? You could say about any team, well, if they have a bunch of injuries. But the problem I have with that idea when someone says, yeah, you could say that about any team. Well, there's no other team that's as old as them, and age and injuries go hand in hand. They are synonymous. So you are more at risk. A guy like Ertz, by the way, last year's the exception when he plays every single game. People are just now assuming he's going to play 17 again this year. And maybe he does, because DQ, Dan Quinn, does an awesome job keeping these guys fairly healthy and keeping them fresh, so to speak, with how he takes care of them. But I just feel like this is one of those storylines that was mentioned. It was a fact that was out there. People saw it, and then we moved on. I think it could be something that we're going to discuss as the season goes on. A couple of tweets here, at Grant H. Paulson, from people talking about things that make them feel young after I went to the circus this weekend. Ozoma says, wrestling, watching WWE.
Mm-hmm.
I do think that's a huge reason for its success. It's almost like Neverland. Like, you're watching John Cena and Cody Rhodes.
I think it's like, it missed my generation, because I couldn't care less.
Well, your generation, so your mid-20s, that was the worst era of wrestling. It was post-Attitude Era, which was the peak. And then it got pretty good again after that. And missed is probably not true, because it was still okay. But I think it was the worst when you were a kid, probably, that it's ever been. Someone said school clothes shopping for their kids brings them back. I love that. going and getting those shoes for the first day of school, getting that outfit you're going to rock. And then somebody else here has a WWE event. We talked about that.
Yeah, WWE.
So you can tweet me, at Grant H. Paulson. Things that make you feel young. The Commanders looking to get a little bit younger with some impact
players. A Super Bowl would make them feel young.
Yeah. Hey, who cares how old they are? They can lift the Lombardi Trophy. That's all that matters. Dorrance Armstrong, a veteran who was brought in last year from Dallas to play with Dan Quinn, back for year two in Washington, coming off of a very strong finish to his first campaign. He'll join us next. Caught up with him after practice right here on The Fan.
Armstrong's the one that sacked him and punched it out, and Frankie Louvu has it.
That was part of a two-sack game for Dorrance Armstrong in Detroit in a two-touchdown win for the Commanders to punch their ticket to the conference championship game last January. Welcome back, Grant and Danny. Danny is out today. Toby Altizer is in. You're listening to The Fan. Dorrance Armstrong got off to a really slow start to the season. Did not have a sack for Washington until week four against Arizona. And matter of fact, he only had three sacks as of week 13 at New Orleans. But that was when he started to pick it up. In Washington's last four games, he had two sacks. And then went on to have 3.5 sacks in the three playoff games. Had a half sack against Tampa, two at the Lions, and then one in the NFC Championship game against Philly. Also had four quarterback hits in those three games. So just a five-sack regular season, playing in 16 of their 17 games. And then he had 3.5 in three games in the playoffs. And I have to imagine getting back to work this offseason, the now 28-year-old defensive end who came over from the Cowboys to follow Dan Quinn, had to have been motivated, feeling like he'd found something in this defense. Got to catch up with him off the practice field today to talk about his familiarity with the scheme and his comfort in year two now in burgundy and gold.
Last year, I feel like guys was just trying to get a feel for the defense, feel for each other, get to know each other. And now, year two, we back with the same guys, plus a little bit more. And our brotherhood is just strong. Our connection on the field, off the field, I feel like that's the main thing that's helping us take that next step to be better.
Back half of last season and into the playoffs, you were rolling with sack count, pressures, hits on the quarterback. What did you attribute to everything kind of coming together in the second half of the season, and how do you try to carry that over?
I would probably say my preparation was a little bit more better. Obviously, the playoffs are super important, and not to say that no game is bigger than the next, but I think I upped my level of preparation.
When you say preparation, you mean like the film study or the work you're putting in on the field, or what felt different or better?
The field study, just knowing my opponent just a little bit more better, and just being able to take things from previous games and lock that in.
You've been in the league for several seasons, obviously mostly with Dallas, but you're still now in year two here where they view you as kind of their top edge. Do you feel like you still have another gear people haven't seen? Like, what is the next step for you and maybe a ceiling you haven't hit yet?
No doubt. I mean, man, all my career, I've been having guys that I've watched as a kid come in and play in front of me. So I've just been a student of the game, soaking it up from them. And I think this year is the year I'm able to put it all together.
What's going to be the key to that? You talked about adding the preparation, obviously staying healthy. Are there areas of your game you worked on this offseason? Like, what were things you went into the lab and really grinded on?
Everything. Body, mind, get off, hands. I mean, everything that helped me be better, prepare for the game, watching film, everything. It's not nothing that I don't think I left out.
Dorrance Armstrong of the Commanders on Grant and Danny. A lot of guys that came over like yourself had played with DQ before, either in Dallas or in other stops. Why do you think he's so popular with players that guys want to follow him around?
He's a hell of a player coach. You know, he take care of us way more than anybody could imagine. He cares for us on and off the field, and guys respect that.
Was that a priority for you, or did it, is it more coincidental that the team that wanted you and paid you also had Dan Quinn, or were you saying, hey, let's figure out where Dan lands and let's go there?
I mean, it was definitely like an option, but I also had other options to explore, so I think I just went with what was comfortable.
Lastly, they bring in Von Miller. He's going to wear a gold jacket one day. Just getting to rush with him and be in the room with him. What types of things do you guys talk about, or what have you picked up on from him?
Man, we talk about Pat Rush all day, every day. Just from day one, I've just been soaking up the game from him because he's, like I said, he's one of those guys who I've been watching before I even got in the league. So I'm blessed to be able to be in the room with him and soak up the game from him.
Quarterback you're happiest that you've sacked, or like, you know, I think of Myles Garrett has this actual like graveyard. Have you seen that?
Yeah, that's dope.
Like, who's the coolest like headstone that you have of guys that you've sacked?
I'm gonna go Aaron Rodgers. That was my first career sack.
Oh really?
Yeah,
that's a good first sack
for sure.
Appreciate you.
Yes, sir.
Dorrance Armstrong gonna try to start as fast as he finished last year. Welcome back, Grant and Danny, and Studio Toby is in for Danny. Ben Standing is going to come up at the top of the hour. I want to talk to Standing about a piece he wrote on Cliff Kingsbury, the offensive coordinator and play caller. Really, really good insight on Kingsbury's offseason and him watching every single play that every single offense in the NFL ran last year, which is pretty amazing. But real quick on the edge position and Dorrance Armstrong, no doubt about it, Von Miller's got to have a big year and be a closer and a finisher late in games. Cleland Farrell and Dietrich Wise are more run stuffers at this point than pass rushers. But Armstrong's significant. And Toby, when I think about this defense, and maybe they're better than we think, they're having a good training camp, you know, if they're above average or even a middle-of-the-pack defense, this should be a double-digit win team because the offense should be really good. The one thing I always stop at and say, I'm not sure, is the pass rush. I just don't know if they're going to get enough consistent pass rush to be quality on that side of the ball. What is your level of confidence in this pass rush?
Not very high, especially from the edge position, but I do think that they're going to be banking on those guys in the interior making a big-time impact. You've got some guys that are paid a lot in there. Daron Payne, they went out and signed Javon Kinlaw. They spent a high pick on Johnny Newton last year. I think that they're banking on those guys being really impactful, and you need guys like Dietrich Wise, like Dorrance Armstrong. Like, Von Miller, to me, can be an impact guy, but he's going to play such little situational snaps. But those guys on the outside, to me, need to be solid against the run, be able to set that edge. But I think they want the interior of that D-line to really be the difference makers and the playmakers on the defensive line.
If you were to guarantee me that they're going to be middle of the road in pass rush, like last year they were 11th in sacks per pass attempt at year's end, I actually think this will be a much improved defense. And if that's the case, it's hard to fathom them not winning 10 or 11 games and being in the playoffs. But I'm just not sold that they're going to be that efficient. Even with the addition of Von Miller, Dorrance Armstrong could go a long way toward making sure that happens. Let's talk to Ben Standing next about his interview and time he spent with Cliff Kingsbury. Very surprisingly, back with Washington. Could this be his final season with Jaden Daniels before getting another head coaching opportunity? That's next on Grant and Danny on The Fan.